Before I start, I thought I'd tell you a little something. They provide the speakers up here with a bottle of water in case they need to hydrate while they're speaking or something. But for me, for some reason, I have this oversized can of super caffeinated beverage provided for me. Apparently, they're concerned about how interesting my lesson might be, and maybe this will help. So if you'll just give me a minute, I'm going to drink this, and then we'll get started. I'm just kidding. Boy. Tough crowd this afternoon. Oh. All right. Who are you? And why do you matter? Would it be right for me to kill you if I found you to be inconvenient? And if not, why not? We're going to talk about the implications to the answers to these questions in the course of our lesson this afternoon. I want to tell you a little bit about this man, Peter Singer, as we start. He's the renowned professor who holds the chair, or the Ira W. DeCamp Chair of Bioethics at the Princeton University for the study of human values. Probably you've heard of Singer. He's controversial. He's often quoted. He's much in demand. And he's been called America's most influential philosopher. And among his provocative statements is this: after ruling our thought and decisions about life and death for nearly 2,000 years, the traditional Western ethic has collapsed, he says. By 2040, it may be that only a rump of hardcore, know-nothing religious fundamentalists will defend the view that every human life from conception to death is sacrosanct. Now, Singer believes that in some situations it may be morally objectionable to kill a pig or a dog, but not a human baby. He advocates involuntary euthanasia for the handicapped or impaired, and he says that recent court rulings in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world permitting the destruction of innocent human life, quote, are the surface tremors resulting from major shifts deep in the bedrock of Western ethics. We are going through, he says, a period of transition in our attitude toward the sanctity of human life. And indeed, we are. We are living during that time of transition. We are witnessing before our very eyes the gradual but steady abandonment of the biblical view of the origin and the nature and the value of human life, and then in turn the digression into a culture of death. The legalization of abortion on demand, the secularization of the culture and the accompanying rise of moral relativism, advances in technology have all made it possible for us to tamper with life at its earliest stages, as well as artificially prolong it at its later stages. And those things have all combined to produce this alarming lack of respect for life in the rise of what I would call death on demand. And in the midst of this profound moral crisis in which we find ourselves today, we need to ask critical questions. Is there any intrinsic value to human life? And if so, what is the basis for it? What constitutes a person? Is every human being a person? And by what criteria do we determine the answer to that? Do all human beings, regardless of their capacity or consciousness or stage of development, have an inherent right to life, the right not to be killed without just cause? May we dispose of human life because it is inconvenient? Is some human life worthy of the protection of law and some not? And if so, who lives and who dies? And who decides? Changes in the ethical landscape and in technology, as I suggested already, have combined to create new challenges which must be confronted urgently by our culture and on which the Lord's church needs to speak. And how we deal with these issues, abortion, embryonic stem cell research, euthanasia, this will have profound implications, brethren, for generations yet unborn. And the prophets of God were not silent on God's will concerning the sanctity of human life and the killing of the innocent. There are a number of pronouncements from the pen of Jeremiah, as we focused on Jeremiah in this lectureship. We'll look at a couple of statements from him which shed light on the value of life and God's attitude toward the unjust destruction of it. And we'll use that as a launching point to discuss the problem that we face as a result of the rejection of the biblical concepts of the meaning and value of human life. We are focusing on the sanctity of life and specifically on the biblical ethic of the sanctity of human life. Now, Jeremiah 1:5 is a text often cited to show the value God places on life even from its very beginning, life in the womb. Jeremiah 1:5, "Before I formed you," God says to the prophet, "before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations." A couple of things I want you to notice here. First of all, it was God who formed Jeremiah in the womb. God is the author of life. God formed him. But notice what God formed in the womb was Jeremiah. Not something that would become Jeremiah at a later point. Not something that had the potential to turn into Jeremiah at a later stage of development. But that something in the womb formed by God was Jeremiah himself. Similar language is used by David in Psalm 139, 13 through 16. We won't look at that text right now. I wish we had time to do that. But like this text, David there as well attributes personhood to life in the womb. And Jeremiah knew he was no mere product of chance. Jeremiah knew that he was formed by God in the womb for a purpose. And brethren, that forms the basis for the sanctity of life view that attributes unique value to all human life from the time of conception. Now, Jeremiah deals with the slaughter of innocent life because conditions in Judah had deteriorated and blood was being shed. Jeremiah 2:34, the blood of the lives of the poor innocents he mentions. And he says, "I found it not by secret search, but plainly." Their lack of regard for life was open. They were shedding blood and it was evident that they had no regard for their fellow man. Jeremiah 7:6 says that the way back to God was to cease shedding innocent blood. If you do not shed innocent blood or walk after other gods to your own hurt, and there are a number of other texts that express similar sentiments and calls for repentance. But especially egregious is Jeremiah addresses was the sacrifice of children to pagan deities. In chapter 7, in verse 31, "They've built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and daughters in the fire, which I did not command, nor did it come into my heart." There are several other references in Jeremiah, chapter 32 and verse 35, and chapter 19, verses 4 and 5, which address this as well. It was first addressed, you remember, by Moses in the Pentateuch, in the law, Leviticus 18:21. "You shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Moloch, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." Those who were found guilty of practicing this were to be stoned to death. And listen to this. Those who refused to execute the practitioners of this child sacrifice also faced the death penalty. So it wasn't just that if you did it, you died, but if you didn't kill the people doing it, if you didn't deal with it, if you didn't address it, it brought the wrath of God and his punishment as well. So apparently, in Jeremiah's time, the people of Judah revived the practice of offering their children apparently in a fashion which involved actually immolating them to pagan deities. And this appears to be more than just a rite of dedication. Some commentators will suggest, well, this idea of passing through the fire wasn't actually burning the children to death. But when you compare it carefully to other texts like Psalm 106, 37, and 38, looking back on these abominations, the psalmist said they sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons and they shed innocent blood. This involved killing the child, the blood of their own sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. And we have here an excavation, or we'll get to in just a moment, providing archaeological evidence for that. When Paul stresses the reason behind it, these horrible abominations, this perverse and repulsive practice of murdering their own children in devotion to pagan gods was a result of their abandonment of the knowledge of God. And Paul talked about that problem among the Gentiles, Romans 1:25. They exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. When you turn from acknowledging God to the worship of self, then we see the terrible abominations that follow as a result of that, and Israel was doing the same. And here are some funeral urns with the remains of children who had been sacrificed in that fashion. And some commentators will suggest that this child sacrifice involved, as probably others have addressed in the course of the lectureship, that it involved heating up a massive image to the god Moloch, or to this pagan deity. It was a hollow metal image. They would burn a fire in it until it was white hot, and then throw their children alive to be burned alive in the outstretched arms of this idol. And of course, we think of ourselves as more sophisticated than to tolerate that kind of unthinkable brutality. And yet, the disposal of human life in our day through legalized abortion on demand is not unlike what was happening at that time. The culture of death in which we find ourselves, as was the case then, is also a rejection of the knowledge of God and a return to the pagan worship of self. We're going to talk about that in the course of the lesson. We're looking at the sanctity of life, and we're reflecting on the culture of death that has no regard for the sanctity of life. Let's think about the modern disregard for life. As horrified as we are by the abominations that were characteristic of Judah in Jeremiah's day, think about what we're seeing in our own time. Since the landmark decision of Roe versus Wade in 1973, we're seeing the continual slaughter on a daily basis of innocent children in the womb. Some 48 million have been butchered in their mothers' wombs in ways equally horrific and perhaps in some cases more so than that which Jeremiah denounced in Israel's adoption of the Canaanite abomination of burning their own children. They handed over their children to the priests of Moloch. Women today hand over their unborn children to the abortionist scalpel or the suction hose. They would beat the drums of Moloch to drown out the shrieks of the child lest the parents' sympathies overwhelm them. Today we soothe the consciences of those advocating abortion by saying, well, a woman's just exercising her right to choose reproductive freedom. On what grounds, brethren, do we permit the killing of the unborn? On what grounds do we allow it? You know, the unborn victims of Violence Act, Lacey and Connor's law that was passed just several years ago, criminalizes the killing of an unborn child, of children in their mother's wombs. So that if a man commits assault on a woman and he kills that unborn child, he is guilty of a crime under the law. Because that, at the federal level, it does something that was already done at the state level in many states. It criminalizes the killing of children in their mother's wombs, except when that killing takes place in an abortion clinic. So killing a child ex utero, out of the uterus, even if the removal of the baby from of the womb occurs in the course of a botched abortion, killing that child out of the womb is a crime. It is murder, according to our law. But killing that same child just a moment before in utero, still in the womb, just even a moment before full-term birth, which, by the way, Roe versus Wade allows, despite the misconceptions that people have, the misinformation resulting from the propaganda of the media, Roe versus Wade allows that, a child to be aborted right up to the moment before birth. Killing that child in utero is acceptable as long as you have the consent of the mother. General Wesley Clark, when he was seeking the nomination for his party for president in 2004, he rejected any restriction on abortion, and he justified it with this statement. He said, "Life begins with the decision of the mother." Now, think about it. Does the will of another person or your location in reference to the womb somehow mysteriously transform you from an inhuman mass of tissue to a human being? Does one's right not to be killed depend on whether or not someone else wants him or whether he's moved a few inches more down the birth canal? Well, that's pure madness. And our purpose here is not to discuss abortion so much as the part that the legalization of abortion on demand has played in giving rise to this culture of death, to a radical challenge to human rights in our time. The Roe decision was based on a rejection of the biblical ethic of the sanctity of life, and its legacy has been to further devalue human life at all stages of development, in or out of the womb. Consider, for example, the link between abortion and infanticide. There are no theological, philosophical, or scientific grounds to justify the notion that only when a fetus possesses certain recognizable characteristics or reaches a certain stage of growth or is viable or is actually removed completely from the womb, that it then becomes a person. There's no way you can justify that. That it's a person only when it is at a certain stage of development or only when she or he has been removed from the womb. And yet, when you look, for example, at this tiny premature baby at only, say, 5 months, 5 or 6 months in the womb, because that child is out of the womb, has greater protection under the law than a baby more than 9 months still in the womb at a far later stage of development. What's the difference? Well, one's in the womb and one is out. Listen to this statement from Supreme Court Justice Stevens, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stevens said, "A 9-month-old, fully sentient fetus on the eve of birth is not a human being." Did you get that? Are you listening? Is not a human being. Well, Peter Singer and others are willing to take the implications of that to their logical conclusion. Singer argues if that's the case, he says it must be admitted that these arguments about abortion apply to the newborn baby as much as to the fetus. And he adds that the fetus does not have the same claim to life as a person, according to the Supreme Court and others, then it appears that the newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. See, supporters of legalized abortion on demand can't offer a persuasive argument as to why he's wrong. He's just bold enough to come out and say the implications of it. If that baby in the womb is not a human being and we may kill it, then after it is out of the womb, we should be able to kill it too. He's right. That's the logical implication of the Roe decision and the others upholding it. Now, a related aspect of this culture of death is the issue of embryonic stem cell research. We've entered the genetic age. Advances in technology present to us issues of life and death that mankind has not before had to face. And this is the newest and most controversial one. Stem cells. Embryonic stem cell research. We keep hearing about this. And we don't have time to go into detail, but let me quickly say, stem cells are unique in that they have not yet differentiated into one of the many other types of cells in the body. And under certain conditions, they can be stimulated to develop it into the cells of various tissues of the body. And researchers are hopeful that they may have the potential to be used for curing debilitating diseases such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or Lou Gehrig's. But just as the case with the Roe decision, the public has been misled on this subject. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation that takes place in this area. For example, the claims for cures are greatly exaggerated and largely unsubstantiated, highly speculative. And yet you'll hear some talk about that it's just a matter of days until, you know, we are able to cure Parkinson's or reverse paralysis, if we can just legalize and fund with government funds embryonic stem cell research. And those are outrageous and unsubstantiated claims that are being made. Another misconception is that when a bill fails to pass to fund embryonic stem cell research, the public will typically be told that it's being banned. Listen, just because the government isn't going to fund it doesn't mean it has been banned. No, I think it should be. But many times people will hear that, well, Bush vetoed a bill funding stem cell research, so it will be presented as, you know, Bush has banned embryonic stem cell research, or just that he's banned stem cell research. And that leads to the other misconception, that is, pro-lifers do not oppose stem cell research. This is a very critical distinction that we have to make. It's not stem cell research that we oppose from a biblical ethic. It's embryonic stem cell research. But many times that distinction is glossed over or not made at all by the media. It is embryonic stem cell research that is the issue. Stem cells can be obtained from other sources that do not require the creation or destruction of a human embryo. And in fact, stem cells obtained in those other ways show more promise for cures than embryonic stem cells. In embryonic stem cell research, human embryos are obtained either through in vitro fertilization or through cloning existing embryos. That's known as therapeutic cloning. But because the C word, cloning, is so objectionable to the public, oftentimes that will be sort of clouded by referring to it as a somatic cell nuclear transfer. But it's cloning an embryo. But the moral problem is to call stem cells from embryos, those embryos have to be destroyed. It requires destroying a human embryo. Well, some say, so what? It's just a clump of undifferentiated cells. It's not a human, or at least not a human being, is the argument. Senator Arlen Specter was asked about this. What about this embryo-destroying research and the question of when human life begins? You know what his reply was? Well, he said, I found it to be helpful not to get into the details. That's just what happens with abortion. No one wants to discuss the details. We're not supposed to discuss what it actually is that's taking place. We're just supposed to talk in broad terms of women's rights and these abstract concepts. But what is it we're talking about? Well, let's not get into the details. Well, the devil's in the details, brethren. And that's where we've got to focus attention. Listen to this. Senator Tom Harkin, in a debate on the Senate floor over funding embryonic stem cell research, took a pencil and he put a dot on a paper and he held it up and he said, you see that? Can anybody even see that dot? We're talking about taking stem cells from something the size of this dot. He said, essentially he was saying, how ridiculous that we're even debating this. It's just a little dot. But Dr. Nigel Cameron responded well to that. And it's true, here you see this a clump of cells, as it's being called, but in fact that's a blastocyst, that's the embryo after it has multiplied several times over into a group of cells, and the whole debate is, well, is this just a dot on the page? But Dr. Nigel Cameron responded, said, what is that dot? It's a human. It's exactly what a human looks like at that stage of development and giving nothing more than proper environment nutrition will grow into someone who could be elected, for example, to the U.S. Senate. And Lee George says, every human adult was once an embryo, just as he or she was once an adolescent. And before that, a child. And before that, an infant. And before that, a fetus. And before that, an embryo. A person is the same human individual that at an earlier point in his life was an adolescent or a child or an infant or a fetus. Those are simply different stages of development of you, of a human person. And so, brethren, opposition to embryonic stem cell research is a matter of maintaining that all human life is worthy of protection at all stages of development, and that we may not dispose of our fellow human beings for our own selfish purposes. See, when you frame it that way, it's a little bit different than saying it's just a dot on the page, isn't it? Speaker of the House, and I hate to ruin your afternoon with that image, but Nancy Pelosi made it. And you can do that when you're on the road, by the way. I can't do that in my home congregation because they pay me there. But Nancy Pelosi made this outrageous assertion. Science is a gift of God, she said, to all of us. And science has taken to us to a place that is biblical in its power to cure. And that is the embryonic stem cell research. Isn't it ludicrous to hear people talk about what's biblical who don't have the slightest idea of what's in the Bible? Science is a gift from God. She went on to say that, this gift from God to destroy human embryos, she said it's a moral responsibility that we do it. Listen, brethren, life is a gift from God. We have a moral, biblical imperative to protect life, not destroy it. Why not simply acquire stem cells from other sources then? Well, the aggressive promotion of embryonic stem cell research, brethren, is about the whole world view on which abortion is based. You see, there's much more at stake than just stem cells and possible cures. If we must protect human life at the embryonic stage, well, then certainly we have to protect it at later stages of development. So abortion proponents cannot permit the protection of life at any stage of prenatal development, because the whole abortion issue to which it is tied is a matter of defending the moral relativism of a secular worldview. It's about moral relativism versus moral absolutism. Ultimately, it is a profoundly important moral and theological question of whether God will rule us or whether we will be our own gods, creating and disposing of life as we see fit. That's what's at stake here. Do we understand that? Are we helping other people to understand that? And this self-determinism, or this idea of personal autonomy that has given rise and contributed and facilitated this culture of death, has put at risk as well the weak, the vulnerable, the unwanted. Advances in the field of medicine and dramatically escalating costs of medical care have converged, providing momentum to the movement to allow killing the disabled, the ill, the unconscious. There's a growing trend in courts and in hospitals and academia toward legalization of physician-assisted suicide and other forms of euthanasia, both voluntary and involuntary. And the growing right-to-die movement, ostensibly about granting rights to individuals to decide when to end their own lives. See, that idea of personal autonomy, I'm my own God, I must be free to do as I please. That really isn't so much about the right to die as the duty to die, the right to be killed. Slogans like death with dignity mask what is really death on demand, the desire to kill those we deem unworthy of life. You know, it was Jack Kevorkian for so long that was the face of the whole euthanasia and death on demand movement, until a couple of years ago a tragic case provided another icon of the right to kill controversy. You know her well, Terri Schiavo. Terri could breathe on her own. She could respond to stimuli, and despite the fact that her parents were willing and wanting to assume full responsibility for her care, Circuit Judge George Greer ordered her feeding tube removed. After 13 days, she died of dehydration in March of 2005. But listen, brethren, this was the first time in our history that the court ordered a person to be starved to death. Now, if a convicted criminal on death row were executed in that fashion, there'd be a public outcry over cruel and unusual punishment. But Terry didn't even receive the protection we give convicted murderers. Why? 2 points. Remember this. Because number one, she was disabled, unable to care for herself. And number two, she was unwanted by the one person with legal authority over her. That's why. That's why she starved to death. And that high-profile case raised the question again of the quality of life versus the sanctity of life debate. And there's reason to believe, brethren, that the killing will escalate as a growing number of hospitals and medical professionals are advocating the futile care theory. And perhaps you've studied this or have been exposed to this idea that when a doctor believes that the quality of a patient's life is not worth living, that doctor can unilaterally refuse wanted medical care. He can simply refuse to get it. And many in the bioethics movement seek to impose this theory through hospital protocols that give anonymous hospital ethic committees the power to refuse medical treatment deemed inappropriate. And so you have what most are unaware of, this quiet advance of the death-on-demand culture, showing how vulnerable are the sick and disabled and those least able to defend themselves. But again, I want you to see the abortion connection here. Killing the disabled or the unwanted is the inevitable outcome, brethren, of the abortion culture made possible by Roe. Listen to Joseph Flesher, who helped popularize and legitimize situation ethics. He said, "It's ridiculous to give ethical approval to the positive ending of human life in utero, in the womb, as we do in therapeutic abortions, but refuse to approve of positively ending a subhuman life in extremis." So if you can kill it when it's starting in the womb, you should be able to kill it later in its final stages. He said it's ridiculous to approve of one and not the other. Well, he's right. Singer said, "The ethical outlook that holds human life to be sacrosanct, I shall call it the sanctity of life view, is under attack." Now listen carefully. He said, "The first major blow to the sanctity of life view was the spreading acceptance of abortion throughout the Western world." Do you see where it has led? The ethical framework that has allowed us to kill the unborn supports infanticide and euthanasia as well, brethren. And in that case, no one is safe. Really, what is being done here is the redefining of personhood. That's what we have done to justify the killing of the unborn and others. This redefinition of personhood denies what is upheld in Scripture, and that is that all human life has value simply because it is human life. But the architects of death who are promoting this ideology of death in our culture are trying to transform the way we think about ourselves. And they're redefining personhood in a way that excludes some humans. They're establishing their own subjective criteria of who is a person and who is not. Consciousness, ability to reason, communicate, sentience, etc. And so they've really just taken Roe and expanded upon it. And they're giving intellectual credibility to what Roe codified, that is the creation of a class of disposable human non-persons. You know, in 2005, there was a London Zoo exhibit where for a number of days, 8 men and women were on display in an enclosure like the other animals in the zoo. And zoo spokeswoman Polly Willis said, "Seeing people in a different environment among other animals teaches the public that the human is just another primate." Is that what you are? Well, you see, this reductionism of man as animal is what allows us to classify some people as non-persons that may be killed. And to do that, we have to discard the supernatural explanation for the origin of man and embrace the naturalistic view of origins, and that is Darwinism. And if we have time at the end of the question and answer session, I'd like to come back, there's a few minutes, and stress how the sanctity of life and everything we've been talking about ultimately is tied to our view of origins. Thank you for your attention.